Esperanza Rising. Grapes. Miguel was the only one who could have taken the money orders. No one doubted that. Alfonso apologized to Esperanza, but Mama graciously said that Miguel must have needed the money to get to Northern California. Alfonso promised the money would be paid back, one way or another, and Esperanza knew it would be, but she was angry with Miguel. How dare he go into her valise and take what was not his, and after all her hard work? Mama seemed to get a little stronger every day, although she still took many naps. Hortensia was happy that she was eating well, and every day Esperanza brought home just-picked fruit to tempt her. A few weeks later, Esperanza stood on the shed dock in the morning and marveled at the peaches, plums, and nectarines that poured into the shed. "How will we ever sort them all?" she asked. Josefina laughed. "One piece at a time. It gets done." She started with the small white clingstone peaches, and then the larger yellow Albertas. Mama loved the white peaches, so Esperanza set aside a bag for her. Then after lunch, they sorted the flaming gold nectarines. Later that afternoon, they would still have to sort a few bushels of plums. Esperanza loved the elephant heart plums. Mottled green on the outside and blood red on the inside, they were tangy and sweet at the same time. She stood in the midsummer sun during her lunch break and ate one, bent over so the juice wouldn't run down her face. Josefina called to her. "Mira," she said, "look, there's Alfonso. What is he doing here?" Alfonso was talking to one of the supervisors. He had never left the field in the middle of the day and come to the sheds. "Something must be wrong," said Esperanza. "Maybe it is the babies," said Josefina, and she hurried toward him. Esperanza could see them talking and slowly began walking toward them, leaving the line of women and the stacks of lugs and plums. She tried to read from Josefina's expressions whether something was wrong. Then Josefina turned to look at her. Esperanza felt the blood drain from her face, and she suddenly knew why Alfonso was here. It had to be Mama. The doctor had said she could have a relapse. Something must have happened to her. Esperanza suddenly felt weak, but she kept walking. "Is it Mama?" "No, no, I didn't mean to alarm you, Esperanza, but I need you to come with me. Hortensia is in the truck." "But it's so early." "It's okay. I talked to the supervisor." She followed him to the truck. Hortensia was waiting inside. "We got a message from Miguel," she said. "We are to meet him at the bus station in Bakersfield at 3 o'clock. He said he is coming from Los Angeles and that we should bring you. That's all we know." "But why would he want me to come?" asked Esperanza. "I can only hope that it's to apologize for his actions," said Hortensia. It was over 100 degrees. Hot wind whipped inside the cab. Esperanza felt the perspiration sliding down her skin beneath her dress. It felt strange to be riding to town on a work day, breaking her routine in the sheds. She kept thinking of all the elephant hearts that the others would have to unpack shorthanded. Hortensia squeezed her hand. "I can't wait to see him," she said. Esperanza offered a tight smile. They arrived at the bus station and sat on the bench in front. The clerks all spoke to one another in English, their hard, sharp words meaning nothing to Esperanza. It always startled her when she heard English, and she hated not knowing what people were saying. Someday, she would learn it. She strained to hear each announcement that was made, finally hearing the words she was waiting for. Los Angeles. A silver bus turned the corner and pulled into the bay in front of the station. Esperanza searched through the passengers seated on the bus, but couldn't see Miguel. She and Hortensia and Alfonso stood up and watched everyone get off. And then, finally, there was Miguel standing in the doorway of the bus. He looked tired and rumpled, but when he saw his parents, he jumped from the steps, grabbing his mother and hugging her, then his father clapping him on the back. He looked at Esperanza and smiled. "I have brought you proof that things will get better," he said. She looked at him, trying to be angry. She didn't want him to think she was glad to see him. "Did you bring back what you have stolen?" "No, but I brought you something better." Then he turned to help the last passenger from the bus, a small older woman trying to get down the steep steps. The sun, reflecting off the shiny bus, glinted in Esperanza's eyes. She shaded them with her hand, trying to imagine what Miguel was talking about. For a moment, she saw un fantasma, a ghost of Abuelita, walking toward her, with one arm reaching out to her and the other pressing on a wooden cane. "Esperanza," said the ghost. She heard Hortensia suck in her breath. Suddenly, Esperanza knew that her eyes were not deceiving her. Her throat tightened, and she felt as if she couldn't move. Abuelita came closer. She was small and wrinkled, with wisps of white hair falling out of her bun at the back of her head. Her clothes looked mussed from travel, but she had her same white lace handkerchief tucked into the sleeve of her dress, and her eyes brimmed with tears. Esperanza tried to say her name but couldn't. Her throat was cramping from her emotions. She could only reach out for her grandmother and bury her head in the familiar smell of face powder, garlic, and peppermint. "Abuelita, Abuelita," she cried. "Aquí estoy. I am here, mi nieta. How I have missed you." Esperanza rocked her back and forth, daring to believe that it was true, looking at her through tears to make sure she was not dreaming, and laughing finally, laughing and smiling and holding her hands. Then Hortensia and Alfonso took their turns. Esperanza looked at Miguel. "How?" she asked. "I needed to have something to do while I waited for work, so I went for her." After they pulled into camp, they escorted Abuelita into their cabin where they found Josefina, Juan, and the babies waiting. "Josefina, where's Mama?" "It was warm, so we settled her in the shade. She fell asleep. Isabel is sitting with her. Is everything all right?" Hortensia introduced Abuelita to Juan and Josefina, whose faces lit up. Esperanza then watched her grandmother look around the tiny room that now held pieces of their new life. Isabel's pictures on the wall, a bowl of peaches on the table, the baby's toys underfoot, Papa's roses in a coffee can. Esperanza wondered what Abuelita thought of the sad conditions, but she just smiled and said, "Please take me to my daughter." Esperanza took Abuelita's hand and led her toward the trees. She could see Mama reclining in the shade near the wooden table. A quilt was spread on the ground nearby where the babies usually played. Isabel was running back from the vineyard, her hands full of wildflowers and grapevines. She saw Esperanza and ran toward her and Abuelita. Isabel stopped in front of them, her face flushed and smiling. "Isabel, this is Abuelita." Isabel's eyes widened and her mouth popped open in surprise. "Do you really walk barefoot in the grapes and carry smooth stones in your pockets?" Abuelita laughed, reaching deep into the pocket of her dress, pulled out a flat, slick stone, and gave it to Isabel. She looked at it in amazement, then handed Abuelita the wildflowers. "I think you and I will be good friends, Isabel, yes?" Isabel nodded and stepped aside so Abuelita could go to her daughter. There was no way to prepare Mama. Esperanza watched Abuelita walk to where Mama slept, resting on the makeshift lounge. She was framed by the vineyard, the grapes ripe and ready to drop. Abuelita stopped a few feet from Mama and looked at her. A stack of lace carpetas was at Mama's side, as well as her crochet needle and thread. Abuelita reached out and stroked her hair, gently pulling the loose strands away from Mama's face and smoothing them against her head. Softly, Abuelita said, "Ramona." Mama did not open her eyes, but said as if she was dreaming, "Esperanza, is that you?" "No, Ramona, it is me, Abuelita." Mama slowly opened her eyes. She stared at Abuelita with no reaction, as if she was not really seeing her at all. Then she lifted her hand and reached out to touch her mother's face, making sure that the vision was true. Abuelita nodded. "Yes, it is me. I have come." Abuelita and Mama uttered no words that anyone could understand. It was their own language of happy exclamations and overwhelming emotions. Esperanza watched them cry, and she wondered if her own heart would burst from so much joy. "Oh, Esperanza," said Isabel, jumping up and down and clapping, "I think my heart is dancing." Esperanza barely choked out the whisper, "Mine too." Then she picked up Isabel and spun her around in her arms. Mama would not let go of Abuelita. She scooted over and made Abuelita sit next to her and held onto her arms as if she might disappear. Suddenly, Esperanza remembered her promise, ran back to the cabin, and returned carrying something in her arms. "Esperanza," said Abuelita, "could that possibly be my blanket? Did you finish it?" "Not yet," she said, unfolding the blanket. Mama held one end, and Esperanza pulled the other end. It reached from the chinaberry tree to the mulberry. It could have covered 3 beds. They all laughed. The yarn was still connected, waiting for the last row to be finished. They all gathered on the quilt, and at the table, Esperanza sat down and pulled the massive blanket next to her, took the needle, and began crocheting the final stitches. When Mama could finally speak, she looked at Abuelita and asked the same thing Esperanza had asked. "How did you get here?" "Miguel," said Abuelita, "he came for me. Luis and Marco have been impossible. If I went to the market, one of their spies would follow me. I think they thought you were still in the area and would eventually come back for me." 10 stitches up to the top of the mountain. Esperanza listened to Abuelita tell Mama about how infuriated Tio Luis had been when he found out they were gone. He'd become obsessed with finding them and questioned all of their neighbors, including Señor Rodriguez. They had even come to the convent to question her sisters, but no one told him anything. Add 1 stitch. A few months after they left, she had a premonition that something was wrong with Mama. The feeling would not let go of her, so she lit candles every day for months and prayed for their safety. 9 stitches down to the bottom of the valley. Then one day, when she had almost given up hope, she found an injured bird in the garden that she did not think would fly again. But the next morning, when she approached it, the bird lifted into the sky. She knew it was a sign that whatever had been wrong was better. Skip 1 stitch. Then one of the nuns brought her a note that someone had left in the poor box addressed to her. It had been from Miguel. He suspected that Abuelita was being watched, so he delivered his notes after dark, telling her of his plan. 10 stitches up to the top of the mountain. Miguel and Señor Rodriguez came in the middle of the night and took her to the train station. It was all very exciting, and Miguel didn't leave her side once during the entire trip. He brought her all the way here. Add 1 stitch. He said that Ramona and Esperanza needed her. "He was right," said Mama, her eyes teary again, gratefully looking at Miguel. Mountains and valleys, mountains and valleys. So many of them, thought Esperanza. When a strand of her hair fell into her lap, she picked it up and wove it into the blanket so that all of the happiness and emotion she felt at this moment would go with it forever. When Esperanza told Abuelita their story about all that had happened to them, she didn't measure time by the usual seasons. Instead, she told it as a field worker, in spans of fruit and vegetables, and by what needed to be done to the land. They had arrived in the valley at the end of the grapes, Thompson seedless, red Malagas, and the blue-black Ribiers. Mama breathed in the dust at the end of the grapes, and that's when she got sick. Then it was time to prune the grapes and get ready for potatoes. Working potatoes was the heart of winter and the cold that dampened the bones, and during potato eyes, Mama had gone to the hospital. There had been no months with names, only the times of tying canes amidst the ghosts of grapes and gray days that never warmed. But afterward came the anticipation of spring and a valley pregnant with needs, graceful asparagus, ripening vineyards, and groaning trees. Then early peaches called. Crickets in the fields started their nighttime symphonies, and Mama came home. Abuelita arrived during plums, and now the grapes were delivering another harvest, and Esperanza was turning another year. A few days before her birthday, Esperanza begged Miguel to drive her to the foothills before sunrise. There was something she wanted to do. She woke in the dark and tiptoed from the cabin. They followed the dirt road that headed east and parked when they could go no further. In the gray light, they could see a small footpath to a plateau. When they got to the top, Esperanza looked out over the valley. The cool, almost morning air filled her senses. Below, she could see the white roofs of the cabins in straight rows, the fields beginning to take form, and over the eastern mountains, a hopeful brightening. She bent over and touched the grass. It was cool, but dry. She lay down on her stomach and patted the ground next to her. "Miguel, did you know that if you lie on the ground and stay very still, you can feel the earth's heart beating?" He looked at her skeptically. She patted the ground again. Then he lay down as she was, facing her. "Will this happen soon, Esperanza?" "Wait a little while and the fruit will fall into your hand." He smiled and nodded. They were still. She watched Miguel watching her. And then she felt it, beginning softly, a gentle thumping repeating itself, then stronger. She heard it, too. Shoomp, shoomp, shoomp. The earth's heartbeat, just like she had felt it that day with Papa. Miguel smiled, and she knew that he felt it, too. The sun peeked over the rim of a distant ridge, bursting the dawn onto the waiting fields. She felt its warmth washing over her and turned on her back and faced the sky, staring into the clouds now tinged with pink and orange. As the sun rose, Esperanza began to feel as if she rose with it, too. Floating again like the day on the mountain when she first arrived in the valley, she closed her eyes, and this time she did not careen out of control. Instead, she glided above the earth unafraid. She let herself be lifted into the sky, and she knew she would not slip away. She knew that she would never lose Papa, or El Rancho de las Rosas, or Abuelita, or Mama, no matter what happened. It was as Carmen, the egg woman, said on the train. She had her family, a garden full of roses, her faith, and the memories of those who had gone before her. But now, she had even more than that, and it carried her up, as on the wings of the phoenix. She soared with the anticipation of dreams she never knew she could have, of learning English, of supporting her family, of someday buying a tiny house. Miguel had been right about never giving up, and she had been right, too, about rising above those who held them down. She hovered high above the valley, its basin surrounded by the mountains. She swooped over Papa's rose blooms, buoyed by rose hips that remembered all the beauty they had seen. She waved at Isabel and Abuelita walking barefoot in the vineyards, wearing grapevine wreaths in their hair. She saw Mama sitting on a blanket, a cacophony of color that covered an acre in zigzag rows. She saw Marta and her mother walking in an almond grove, holding hands. Then she flew over a river, a thrusting torrent that cut through the mountains. And there, in the middle of the wilderness, was a girl in a blue silk dress and a boy with his hair slicked down, eating mangoes on a stick, carved to look like exotic flowers, sitting on a grassy bank on the same side of the river. Esperanza reached for Miguel's hand and found it, and even though her mind was soaring to infinite possibilities, his touch held her heart to the earth. These are the morning songs which King David used to sing to all the pretty girls. We sing them here to you. Awake, my beloved, awake! See, it is already dawn. The birds are already singing. The moon has already gone. On the morning of her birthday, Esperanza heard the voices coming from outside her window. She could pick out Miguel's, Alfonso's, and Juan's. She sat up in bed and listened, and smiled. Esperanza lifted the curtain. Isabel came over to her bed and looked out with her clutching her doll. They both blew kisses to the men who sang the birthday song. Then Esperanza waved them inside, not to open gifts, but because she could already smell coffee coming from the kitchen. They gathered for breakfast. Mama and Abuelita, Hortensia and Alfonso, Josefina and Juan, the babies and Isabel. Irene and Melina came too with their family. And Miguel. It wasn't exactly like the birthdays of her past, but it would still be a celebration under the mulberry and chinaberry trees with newborn rosebuds from Papa's garden. Although there were no papayas, there was cantaloupe, lime, and coconut salad, and machaca burritos topped with lots of laughter and teasing. At the end of the meal, Josefina brought out a flan of almonds, Esperanza's favorite, and they sang the birthday song to her again. Isabel sat next to Abuelita at the wooden table. They each held crochet hooks and a skein of yarn. "Now watch, Isabel. 10 stitches up to the top of the mountain?" Abuelita demonstrated, and Isabel carefully copied her movements. The needle rocked awkwardly, and at the end of her beginning rows, Isabel held up her work to show Esperanza. "Mine is all crooked." Esperanza smiled and reached over and gently pulled the yarn, unraveling the uneven stitches. Then she looked into Isabel's trusting eyes and said, "Do not ever be afraid to start over." Author's note: I can still see my grandmother crocheting blankets in zigzag rows. She made one for each of her 7 children, many of her 23 grandchildren. I am the eldest of the grandchildren. And for the great-grandchildren she lived to see. My grandmother, Esperanza Ortega, was the inspiration for this book. When I was a young girl, Grandma used to tell me what her life was like when she first came to the United States from Mexico. I had heard stories from the company farm camp where she lived and worked, and the lifelong friends she made there. When she talked about those people and how they had helped her through desperate, trying times, she sometimes cried at the memories. It wasn't until I had children of my own that my grandmother told me about her life in Mexico, about a fairy tale existence with servants, wealth, and grandeur, which had preceded her life in the company farm camp. I wrote down some of her recollections from her childhood. How I wished I had written down more before she died, because I could never stop wondering about her transition from Mexico to California and what it must have been like. Eventually, I started to imagine a story based on the girl who might have been her. This fictional story parallels her life in some ways. She was born and raised in Aguascalientes, Mexico. Her father was Sisto Ortega and her mother Ramona. They lived on El Rancho de la Trinidad, which I changed to El Rancho de las Rosas, and her uncle did hold prominent positions in the community. A series of circumstances, including her father's death, eventually forced my grandmother to immigrate to the United States to a company-owned farm labor camp in Arvin, California. Unlike Esperanza in the story, my grandmother had already married my grandfather, Jesus Munoz, when she immigrated to California. Like Miguel, he had been her father's mechanic. In the segregated Mexican camp, with my grandfather, she lived much like the characters in the story. She washed her clothes in communal tubs, went to Jamaica's on Saturday nights, and cared for her first 3 daughters. That's where my mother, Esperanza Munoz, was born. During the early 1930s, there were many strikes in the California agricultural fields. Often growers evicted the strikers from their labor camps, forcing many to live together in makeshift refugee camps, sometimes on farms on the outskirts of towns. The growers were powerful and could sometimes influence local governments. In Kern County, sheriffs arrested picketers for obstructing traffic, even though the roads were deserted. In Kings County, one Mexican man was arrested for speaking to a crowd in Spanish. Sometimes the strikes failed, especially in areas that were flooded with people from states like Oklahoma, who were desperate for work at any wage. In other instances, the strong voices of many people changed some of the pitiful conditions. The Mexican repatriation was very real and an often overlooked part of our history. In March of 1929, the federal government passed the Deportation Act that gave countries the power to send great numbers of Mexicans back to Mexico. Government officials thought this would solve the unemployment associated with the Great Depression. It didn't. County officials in Los Angeles, California, organized deportation trains, and the Immigration Bureau made sweeps in the San Fernando Valley and Los Angeles, arresting anyone who looked Mexican, regardless of whether or not they were citizens or in the United States legally. Many of those sent to Mexico were native-born United States citizens and had never been to Mexico. The number of Mexicans deported during this so-called voluntary repatriation was greater than the Native American removals of the 19th century and greater than the Japanese-American relocations during World War II. It was the largest involuntary migration in the United States up to that time. Between 1929 and 1935, at least 450,000 Mexicans and Mexican-Americans were sent back to Mexico. Some historians think the numbers were closer to 1 million. Even though my grandmother lived in this country for over 50 years, I can still remember her breaking out in nervous perspiration and trembling as her passport was checked at the border when we returned to the United States from a shopping trip in Tijuana. She always carried the fear that she would be sent back on a whim, even though repatriation had long been over. My father, Don Bell, came to California during the Dust Bowl from the Midwest and ironically worked for the same company farm where my mother was born. By that time, my grandmother had moved her family to a small house in Bakersfield at 1030 P Street. Mom and Dad weren't destined to meet quite yet. Dad was 12 years old when he picked potatoes during World War II with the diaper crew, children paid to pick the fields because of the great shortage of workers due to the war. He says the children weren't always the most diligent employees and admits he more often threw dirt clods at his friends than he picked potatoes. Later, when he was 16, he spent a summer working for the same farm, driving trucks back and forth from the fields and delivering workers. Much of our nation's produce comes from this one area in California. It is hot in the summer and cold in the winter. There are dust storms and tool fog, and some people do contract valley fever. Before I got married, I took the required blood test in San Diego, where I had lived during my college years. The doctor called because of an urgent finding on my lab results. I worried that something dramatic had been found until the doctor said, "You tested positive for valley fever." I let out a sigh of relief. I grew up seeing lugs of grapes on kitchen tables. I picked plums, peaches, apricots, nectarines, persimmons, almonds, walnuts, and pecans from backyard trees. Every year in August, I saw the grapes laid down on the ground to make raisins the same way they've been made for generations. Lemons, tomatoes, or squash appeared on our doorsteps from neighbors or my grandmother's gardens. I had never been conscious of having any symptoms of valley fever. The only fever I recollected was my burning affection for my beginnings and belongings. "Of course I tested positive," I said to the doctor. "I grew up in the San Joaquin Valley." I knew that I had been naturally immunized to the actual disease by merely living there, from the air I had breathed growing up. My family's feelings for the company camp are deep-rooted and still filled with loyalty for their start in this country and for the jobs they had at a time when so many had none. Most of the people I interviewed who lived in the same camp with my grandmother held no grudges against the Oklahomans or others who competed for their jobs at that time. One man I interviewed said, "We were all so poor. The Okies, the Filipinos, they were poor too. We all knew the feeling of wanting to work and feed our families. That was why it was so hard for so many of us to strike." When I asked about prejudice, I was told, "Sure, there was prejudice, horrible prejudice, but that's how things were then. Many struggled just to put food on the table and sometimes seemed to be resigned to the social issues of the time. They focused only on survival and put their hopes and dreams into their children's and grandchildren's futures. That's what Grandma did. She survived. All of her children learned English, and so did she. Some of her children went to college. One became a professional athlete, another a member of the United States Foreign Service. Others became secretaries, a writer, an accountant. And her grandchildren? Newscasters, social workers, florists, teachers, film editors, lawyers, small business owners, and another writer, me. Our accomplishments were her accomplishments. She wished the best for all of us and rarely looked back on the difficulties of her own life. It is no wonder that in Spanish, Esperanza means hope.